regulate shirts was scrambled, and I figured if I'm going to do it, it should at least be in a room in which the person gets paid at the end. But at the last minute, I couldn't force the sight of my white, wobbly, freckle and mole-covered monstrosities onto another person, not even one I tell my darkest secrets to. But there's one more secret she doesn't know. My upper arms also have a light dusting of... Now, what do you think I'm going to say here? Let's play a guessing game. Is it powdered sugar? Glitter? Rainbows? Happy faces? Raised pink dots, irritated to varying degrees, and maybe a little dried blood, because I like to pick at them when I'm bored, because sometimes you can find and liberate an ingrown hair. Ding, ding, ding. I've read a million articles in women's magazines that purport to get your arms ready for summer in 5 easy steps. Which summer are we talking about? Nuclear summer? Camus' Invincible summer? Summer 2040? Or the one a few weeks away? If it's that one, I just don't think a few arm curls are going to do it. I need something faster. Can't they just paint on some muscles and shade the rest? Where are we with arm painting technology? You don't hear enough about trompe l'arm. And I hate that I'm wasting this much time thinking about my arms when I have so many more important things to think about, like my hair. The other day, I went clothes shopping with my mother because I was in a good mood and wanted it to dissipate. So let me ask you this, I said, turning to her in a tank top, my upper arms undulating like a just vacated waterbed. If I were to wear this in public, would the reaction be like, there goes a fat person, or there goes a small person with fat arms? She looked at me like she questioned whether I'd really been going to therapy. I think I've been convinced this whole time, after weight loss and exercise and dieting and growing up, that there's still something about my body, or something about me, really, that if it were exposed would change the entire way I come across, and possibly even jeopardize relationships and employment. And all the exhausting work I've done to be the person I am today would simply disappear, and I'd be standing there, awkward, fat, frizzy, and scared, all because I exposed a flabby arm, or thigh, or sweat stash. The thing is, the body part I'm convinced I have to hide, the physical portal to the past, keeps changing. That's probably because it's a feeling more than anything. It's for this reason I have no choice but to move to Antarctica. I realize I cannot run my arms or my past, but I'd rather face them in a jacket. I still feel the same way about hot weather, but I've realized since having a child, I'm no longer trying to be the hot girl. I think you just hit a certain age where you're aged out of hot girlness. So in a way, that's liberating and also sort of sad, but ultimately more liberating. I still walk around way too insecure and way too self-conscious, but this idea that it's like a transgression against society to possibly expose a flabby arm, I'm hopefully beyond that. The Impossible Shower. And the illustration on this one is... It's that spiral, like you're going into the Twilight Zone spiral thing. And then there's a hairdryer, a door, a shower head, and a clock, all in the midst of the spiral. My favorite sensation is that of having just taken a shower, when I'm feeling clean, smooth, refreshed, and like I've accomplished something, namely showering. My second favorite sensation is that of being in the shower, under the nozzle, enveloped by steam and hot water. My third is being left alone with a breadbasket and an overflowing leprechaun pot's worth of gold foil-covered packets of butter, but that's beside the point. Considering my feelings about showering, you might imagine I spring from the sheets in the morning and make a beeline for the shower, a smile on my face and a song in my heart, ready to face another great day. You might imagine this, but you'd be sorely mistaken. What kind of asshole do you think I am? On the contrary, I waste inordinate amounts of time trying to find the motivation to shower. It's as if an impenetrable force field surrounds the bathroom, and I'm trapped on the outside with Google and Twitter and a million distractions. I love feeling clean, but apparently what I love more is Googling episodes of TV shows I saw when I was so young that I'm left wondering whether I imagined them. In the case of the episode of The Facts of Life that was a send-up of The Twilight Zone, where Blair was moosed to death, it really existed. By the way, I just said The Facts of Life, not Facts of Life, even though I purport to be the world's foremost authority on the show. If someone told me how much time I would spend as an adult trying to figure out how to manage my time, I never would have believed them. I'd say a good third of my day is spent figuring out when to shower. Another third is spent trying to figure out how to shave my armpits in a way that both removes hair and doesn't leave me looking and feeling as if I slid pits first on a bumpy gravel road. The last third is spent debating insignificant online purchases. It's amazing I get anything done. About the armpit thing, a friend of mine, when I was polling people, how do you do this how do you both remove the hair and also not be all irritated and scraped afterwards? And a friend of mine who did not have any answers but did commiserate said it's like trying to shave the inside of a bowl. But every time I mention the shower issue, people tell me how they relate. If you aren't relating, it's likely you work normal daytime hours. Consider yourself among the lucky and very mature. For those of us who work evenings, as I do, or work from home or are unemployed, structuring a day can prove challenging, especially if you have nowhere to go and no one to see. Why waste all that grooming? I remember when the conservation of grooming began. It was when I was in my late teens and early 20s, when the idea of staying home on a Friday night was unthinkable, but most plans were made at the last minute. Because it took me forever to get ready, I would begin the process early in the day, on the off chance I'd have somewhere to go. These were the days before Brazilian or Japanese hair straightening, when if you had curly hair and wanted to wear it straight, which I always did, you had to rely on a blow dryer, a paddle brush, some kind of oily pomade, and a drought. The longer you ran the blow dryer, the hotter you would get, and the sweat and heat coming off your head would make the sections of hair you'd already straightened curl again. You would focus your attention on one location, and frizz would spring up in another. It was like whack-a-mole, but on my scalp. All of this was to achieve a damaged swirl of dry, frizzy hair that in no way resembled the naturally straight-flowing locks I coveted. Imagine taking a cotton ball and stretching it out until it was kind of flat and rectangular, and then imagine it being black and giant and protruding from the back of my head. That's what my hair looked like, and it took me hours to achieve that look. Then there was the makeup and the accessories and the trying and retrying of all the clothes in my closet, all of which was done on spec. I basically set aside the entire day to appear spontaneous. If I ended up not going out, I felt awful and foolish because I'd spent so much time getting ready. And for what? To sit by the phone? It was a waste of mascara. So maybe that's why the pendulum has swung so far in the other direction. I basically won't start getting ready until it's too late for me to be on time. I should Google time management. So after having a baby, my whole when to shower conundrum has changed. It's less about like I should shower, I don't have the motivation, and more just figuring when can I shower and can I time it to his nap or when someone else will be able to watch him. My whole schedule has changed since having a baby because I definitely was not a morning person before and now I've had to become a morning person. And I like to shower in the morning. However, schedule-wise, it would definitely work best to shower in the evening. But I can't cross that thing that needs to be crossed. You know what I'm saying. Okay, then. And yes, I'm aware that I seem to end every aside with, okay, then. Or at least most of them. My imaginary cape friends. The illustration is a computer. It is my computer. And it's like a Facebook page for Cape Cod. And there's a little like button and the cursor is on top, is hovering over the like button. The person I wish I was is far more social than the person it seems I am. I say it seems because I still hold out hope that one day I'll wake up a completely different person. One who prefers capri pants to sweats, and summers at a beachfront cottage on some sort of cape with several other witty and charming couples. Nights at this balmy locale would be spent drinking wine and playing bunco or bridge, neither of which I know how to play. Days would involve gaiety of some sort on or near a pier, and perhaps a sumptuous stroll into town. Everything would be breezy and glamorous and fun, save for that lively disagreement, the kind we'd reference for years after, over how to prepare fresh lobster. Perhaps it would turn into an annual vacation, and I'd have a whole wardrobe of sarongs and hats. I'd probably keep them in a steamer trunk with a label that says, For the Cape, along with other precious keepsakes. When I was growing up, in 17 and Teen magazines, both of which I read, there were ads for this kind of chest. I think it was called a Lane chest, and it's like where you would keep all your keepsakes. And if I remember correctly, the ad was a girl sitting by the window with her chest, and the sun was kind of, it was like hazy and the sun was beaming in. And I know that there were ballet slippers that were going in the chest. If anyone else is old, they might remember this. In this alternate universe, inspired by a J. Crew catalog, I'm living a fabulous life made rich and meaningful through dazzling get-togethers, galas, social outings, tennis matches, heart-to-hearts, laughter, and great friendship. Like something in between The Great Gatsby and the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. In real life, I mostly hang out alone or with my fiancé and stay loosely connected to all my friends via Facebook, Twitter, and email. Some days I decide that I really must make the time to get together with this person or that person, as they are old friends, the kind you can just pick up with after time has passed and it feels exactly the same. Then I'll blink and 2 years will have gone by and I'll realize I haven't done it. And that's fine, sort of, except I'm afraid this is how it could go for the rest of my life, putting off seeing friends in 2-year increments until one day I die. It's depressing. So then I say to myself, I should just have a party and invite all the friends I haven't seen in forever and catch up with all of them at once. I do long to be the party hosting kind, but when was the last time you had a meaningful conversation with anyone at a party? Somehow you end up saying hi and bye to the people you want to talk to and spending the rest of the time buttonholed by Sheila's cousin who just left a big agency to open a boutique PR firm and can she connect with you on LinkedIn? It's gotten to the point where as I'm putting on my bra to leave the house, an act I regard as a gift I give to the world and a sign I'm playing by their rules, since left to my own devices, I'd shuffle around in an oversized t-shirt and sweatpants, I soothe my mounting anxiety by telling myself that in a few short, sweet hours, I will be able to return home to my comfortable state of braless torpor. There are extroverts, there are introverts, and then there's me, someone who is folding in on herself. That's how much I don't feel like leaving the house to make small talk. Granted, I have my moments, as well as a career that involves stretches of extreme extroverted activity. But the vast majority of time, I feel like my batteries are drained and I need a nap. And so help me, if the phone rings, I'm sending it to voicemail faster than you can say, I actually enjoy talking to that person, but now is a bad time. In this alternate universe, though, when the phone rings, I jump on it because it could be Sue or Karen or Millie or any of my many, many friends from the Cape. I don't hear from my Cape friends very often because we're all living such dynamic and fulfilling and busy lives. But when I do, I seize upon the opportunity to catch up. Hours pass in a reverie of laughter and memories and sometimes even tears of joy. Of course, there goes the afternoon. Looks like someone won't be playing croquet, but that's just what happens when you're reminiscing about clam bakes with Karen. Incidentally, her full name is Ted and Karen. All my Cape friends are one half of a dynamic couple. There's Doug and Sue, Ted and Karen, and Biff and Millie. There's also Art and Arlene, but they're dead to me, ever since Arlene ripped the last haddock right from my hands at the local fishmonger. I mean, have you ever? I have never. In this universe, though, I not only don't hang out with these couples, I don't even know anyone with these names. I've got a real shortage of 1- and 2-syllable 70s names and a surplus of mics. If anyone needs a mic, I'll trade you for a Karen, Ted, or Sue. I want to say the reason I'm not living this extended montage of a life, like the one I think my parents lived at my age, is that today we get our fill of fellow human beings at our jobs. The way we live and work now, putting career before just about everything, being connected to our jobs around the clock, by that I mean always looking at Twitter, leaves very little left for clam bakes and the like. I want it to be that and not my own shortcoming. Now, if you'll excuse me, Millie's cousin Tilly is in town, and my presence is requested on the pier. I think I was grappling a little more with feeling, like that line where I say, there's extroverts and there's introverts and then there's me, someone who's folding in on herself. My life has changed a bit in that then I was not working at home and I was traveling a lot more for work, whereas now I work from home. I haven't traveled for work in a while, although I am a bit next year. So I don't know. I don't have that, like, that small talk is going to kill me. I just need to sleep feeling, even though I do feel tired all the time. I guess what I mean to say is I feel like my batteries are drained a lot now, given the lifestyle of having a baby, but I don't feel like my soul is drained like I did before. I know that is very dramatic, arguably melodramatic. That's just me, you guys. The highway is trying to kill me. The illustration is a sign on the side of the road with the mileage, or the miles, really, with the miles to the next towns, and it says Fender Bend 10, Flat Tireburg 24, Santa Barbara 112. Yesterday, on our way up the coast to look at wedding venues, my fiancé and I found ourselves on the business end of a wee Fender Benderoonie, which is my cute name for something unpleasant that will likely be a costly and aggravating time suck. It wasn't our fault, mind you. But from what everyone tells me, fault and blame are neither here nor there when it comes to car accidents. While my fiancé handled the details, I am reminded of an aside I made earlier where I mentioned that I feel like people who use the word fiancé sound like this. Fiancé, 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 my fiancé, my fiancé. Did I mention I have a fiancé? My fiancé. And I still feel like that upon rereading all this. And I'm wondering, should I just change his name to Daniel, which is his name, in this, even though I wrote my fiancé? It's an intriguing thought. While Daniel handled the details, I sat dazed in the passenger seat, thinking about how much car accident protocol has changed. In my day, shortly after I got my license, when I was nowhere near ready to drive, despite what the state of California thought, an accident involved pulling over and then nervously sitting in your car, hoping the person who emerged from the dented vehicle in front of you didn't want to kill you. To this end, you screwed up your face into an approximation of tears and said sorry a zillion times, even though your insurance company would later tell you that was a mistake. If this worked to neutralize the anger coming at you, you shuffled around your overstuffed glove compartment, sifting through batteries, perfume, New West perfume, that was my signature scent in the teen years, a tangle of sunglasses, an unopened compass, this was way before GPS, that seemed like a good purchase at the time, a flashlight, lip gloss and cassettes, both of which were melting, and fished out your registration. Then you exchanged information and tried to scribble down the other person's details, even though your hand was shaking uncontrollably. After this, you found the nearest payphone to call your parents. Now, everyone just calmly snaps photos on their iPhone. "You okay?" asked one of the drivers, tapping on my window. She'd been in a car that had both gotten hit and hit someone else. I nodded. Once we were back on the road, my fiancé, who held it together during the photo snapping, but whose hand was now curling into a ball, an upsetting new trick he didn't know was in his body's repertoire, reminded me that we'd very nearly gotten into an accident a year before on this same stretch of highway. And then, proving that immunity is a thing that only exists on reality shows, a car almost swerved into us in roughly the same spot on the way back. I'm not a superstitious person, but what the hell? If this is a sign, and that's a big if, what is it a sign of? That we should avoid this road? That we shouldn't get married north of Los Angeles County? That we shouldn't get married at all? Again, I'm not a superstitious person, save for a refusal to wake up when the clock is on a 0 or 5, everyone wakes up on a 0 or 5, I prefer 8:01, and a marked incredulity when people tempt fate by opening umbrellas indoors. But I was beginning to wonder whether we're taking our life in our hands. It sounds preposterous, but 100% of the time we've driven to Santa Barbara, we've either had to swerve to avoid an accident or gotten in one. What is the meaning of this? I want to say it means nothing, because that makes me the most comfortable and is the most in accordance with my lack of belief system. But the truth is, I'm afraid to make the drive again. I'm reminded of my dating days, when there was a disparity between my head and my heart. I frequently found myself in the situation where I liked someone and wanted it to work out, but felt some combination of negative emotions every time I saw the person. So much of growing up has been about learning to trust my feelings, even when my intellect is trying to reason them away, which is all good and fine, except when you know the feelings, like the ones I'm having now regarding a particular stretch of the 101 freeway, are irrational. I am an atheist. I believe in nothing. And yet I'm honestly entertaining the notion that the universe may be trying to tell me something and or is out to get me. And the real kick in the hiney is that we kind of fell in love with the first venue we saw, the one in Santa Barbara on the other side of the highway that's trying to kill us. I ask you, what would you do? And don't say arrive by helicopter or horse, because I've seen The Bachelorette and I'm pretty sure that's bad luck. We did end up getting married at that first venue we saw in Santa Barbara, and things did go awry. We did not get into another accident on the way there, though. So driving, it was fine. But maybe the universe was trying to tell me something. And also, a couple things. When I say that I don't like to get up on a 0 or 5, which is true, I also don't like to set the microwave on a 0 or a 5. I like to just, you know, they zig, I zag. But saying that I was the kind of person who liked to get up at 8:01, that's some real BS right there, because at this point in my life, I worked evenings, did not have a child, did not have to get up early, so I was not waking up at 8:01. I think I was just saying that to try to appear like a more achievement-oriented, well, I am achievement-oriented, just to appear more like a morning person. Look at me, trying to curry favor. People who care what time other people get up, which is a lot of people apparently, because one time on my podcast, so I have been a journalist for years. I don't do print journalism as much anymore, but I was doing some Q&As for a magazine with celebrities, and I was supposed to interview Kevin Hart, and they wanted to schedule it at 8 a.m., and I wanted to see if there's any way it could be a little bit later. I was willing to do it that early if it had to be that early, but I just knew it would be better if it could be a little bit later, and I mentioned this on my podcast, and so many people were so offended that I had the temerity to ask if it could be later. And by the way, I think we ended up doing it early, and I think it ended up being fine. And now 8 a.m. is late in the morning for me, given that I'm a 6 a.m. or pre-6 a.m. kind of person. Also, regarding superstition, I really do have a problem with people opening up umbrellas indoors. And my mom is a real indoor umbrella opener. We went umbrella shopping one time, and she liked to open them in the store, which I understand. I understand you want to see, like, how big is this umbrella, and is it broken or anything? But I was really made uncomfortable by that. You know, because I'm a science-based person. Blame the car. The illustration for this one is a convertible and has a license plate. This is Carlos on it. The reason for that will become apparent shortly. I've never really thought of myself as a car person, let alone a car snob. My favorite car is the one someone else is driving, and if I ever win the lottery, I'm going to hire a chauffeur so I can sit in an air-conditioned vehicle, alternately snoozing and checking Twitter. I'm also going to install a salad bar in my living room, but that's neither here nor there. I'm currently in the market for a new car, so I've been dragging anyone willing, and some who aren't, with me on test drives. I was recently explaining my car philosophy to someone, that I'm a level-headed person who just needs a safe, reliable, functioning car. Nothing fancy. When my younger sister began clearing her throat. Apparently, she's still upset about a certain very baffling weekend during which I discovered, behind the right set of wheels, I go from zero to maniac in a matter of minutes. We were living in New York City at the time, and I was working for a magazine that was putting together a travel issue. The theme was road trips. We were each supposed to set out on a jaunt in a different car and then record our impressions. I didn't specifically ask for a fully loaded convertible sports car, but I didn't turn it down either. How was I supposed to know it would change me? I'm normally a cautious driver, But suddenly I was doing 90 miles per hour, darting in and out of traffic, honking impatiently at blue hairs, and, most troublingly, smiling smugly at my fellow sports car driving motorists. I remember distinctly seeing other people on the road with the same kind of car that I had at the time. It was not my car. This is the car that I'm writing about here. And thinking, look at that kindred spirit. I was a fraud. Can we please put the top up, pleaded my increasingly frizzy-haired sister as we zipped down the highway on our way to Stonington, Connecticut, about 140 miles away. I may have pretended I didn't hear her, as I wasn't about to let her requests or the fact that it was beginning to rain interfere with my full enjoyment of the convertible. We'd cobbled together a tour of coastal southern Connecticut, but at the last minute I decided that instead of staying at a cheesy but fun-looking hotel, we should stay at a luxurious inn. The person who drives this car belongs at an inn. I am the person who is driving this car. I belong at an inn. But it was the wrong call. The 18-room bed and breakfast was lovely, but not for us, seeing as we neither owned yachts nor had sex with each other. After dinner, we strolled back through the sleepy town to our romantic private room with a fireplace and a single king bed. Just stay on your side, my sister hissed before slamming off the light. And that's when it started, the need to get back in the car. My fingers yearned to grip the steering wheel. My feet ached to grace the pedals. In the space of a day, I'd formed a relationship with the car that verged on sexual. I couldn't get it out of my mind. The next day, we ventured into Mystic and strolled along the cute seaside shops, peeked our heads into Mystic Pizza, like the movie, and then hit the aquarium. Side note, why must all aquariums smell like sardines and seal piss? Is there not some kind of industrial-strength Febreze that could tackle this odor, or a giant-scented candle? I went through a candle phase in college, and all my belongings from that time still reek. I have textbooks that smell like honeydew. Let's get on this, people. Then, in an effort to bring my miserable sister around, I suggested the Mohegan Sun Casino and Resort, situated on land owned by the Mohegan tribe, which was really only about 20 minutes from Mystic, give or take the 5 hours I tacked on for scenic motoring. Also, if I remember correctly, we got very lost on the way there. But I didn't mind, because I loved the car. I would have happily driven to Canada. That's how close I was to achieving the platonic ideal of Farfignugan. But my wind-whipped sister, by this point looking like the Unabomber, with only a tiny sliver of face showing behind sunglasses and a hoodie pulled tightly around her head, didn't share my devil-may-care attitude. Once at the casino, where we were shown to our room by a woman named Walks Alone, whom I heard refer to herself as Paula on the phone, we settled in for a rejuvenating couple of days of swimming and relaxing. I would have rather been driving the whole time. I kept trying to ask my sister. I was thinking perhaps that if she got a taste of Carlos, oh yes, did I mention I gave the car a name, she might feel less like she'd been hoodwinked into coming on a 3-day test drive disguised as a fun trip. But I couldn't get the word all the way out. It was stuck. As a concession, I agreed to keep the top up on the drive home, and I only went a few hours out of our way. A couple things. The car that I test drove on the long test drive jaunt to Connecticut was a Mercedes CLK 550, I think. They don't make the car anymore, and it had a ton of horsepower. And it was the most, it truly felt like the car was an extension of my body. It wasn't like I press the gas and then the car goes. It was like I press the, like, as one we go. And the steering, it just, I don't know, the whole, like, I've never experienced that in a car. And I no longer, like, I've had subsequent cars since the one I had at the time. And I still have never experienced anything as fun as that car. I do think it is because of the insane amount of horsepower that that car had. I think. I don't know. Also, the part where I was trying to say to my sister, do you want to drive? But I was like, do you want to, you know, and I kept getting stuck, reminds me of something my dad used to do when I was a kid and we would want him to tell us a story. He would go, once upon a, once upon a, once upon a, once upon a, and then he would say his once upon a was stuck. It was funny the first time and funny in retrospect. At the time, it was just frustrating. Tropical attire encouraged. Guys, this is the titular, if you will, which you will, story. The illustration for this one is based on an actual photo, and it is four fashionable, petite, blonde women in the front. It's like a picture of these four blonde women. And then in the very background, there's me, unaware that I'm in the shot, wearing all black, with my hand up to my neck, like just looking awkward and ill at ease. And this was an actual photo. I was invited to a party at Maria Menounos' house, had a very good time, and then she posted photos from the party, and there was one of her and three of her friends, and then in the very background, you see me. And I posted it on Instagram with the caption, and like with a little arrow pointing to me, because you wouldn't see me at first when you look at the photo. And the caption was, I am effortlessly social and always, what is it? This is a wonderful aside. I am effortlessly social and always the center of it. I think it was, I'm effortlessly social and always the center of attention. And now I got to just find it. I'm not sure it was worth it because I just spent some time digging into my Instagram. And it turns out it was what I said it was before. I'm effortlessly social and always the center of attention. In fact, it's tempting to make that picture the cover of the book. However, I feel like it's weird to put out a book with an image of someone who's recognizable. I mean, first of all, we had to get, of course, get permission from all the people in the photo. But it just, I think it would be confusing to people. Like, oh, it's Maria Menounos' book. What? You know, et cetera. All right. A friend of mine has been texting me nonstop today to find out whether I'm going to a tiki party tonight. Clearly, he doesn't know me well. If there's one thing I don't like, it's a good time. And if there's another, it's a costume party that demands skimpy attire, which is the only kind of costume party there is. Can't we have some kind of warm your tootsies by the fire snow party where you're encouraged to come dressed as your favorite avalanche survivor? Who are these people longing for a chance to take it all off? It's currently summer in Los Angeles. How many more pieces can be removed before we're just naked? I realize I sound like an awful prude, but that isn't it at all. I'm very liberated in spirit. I'm just not liberated in wardrobe. I'm all for being as free as you want. I just don't want to have to join in because I have a mind made for fast living and a body made for Norway. Is it cold in Norway? You get what I'm saying. Have you ever seen one of those eggs with a shell that didn't form and harden all the way for some reason, so it's kind of pinkish and soft and translucent? You might need to have spent significant time with an egg-laying chicken or duck, which I have, long story, to know what I'm talking about. But anyway, that's the color of my skin, deformed eggshell. I'm also wobbly and squishy. I have abs in there, but I don't know how many. If a great set of abs is a six-pack, then I think I might have a four-pack of something soft, like Capri Sun. You could try to bounce a quarter off my juice pouch abs, but it would hurt, so please don't. But back to this soiree and the texts I'm ignoring. The invite says tropical attire encouraged. I like that it's not so pushy as to say dress code enforced, which is up there with no substitutions in terms of rules that make me want to break them just because you're not the boss of me. But I also find it a bit misleading because I guarantee if I show up in my preferred summer wear of a sweater and jeans, I will be the only one. And then I will have to field the question, aren't you hot, all night? Do you know how hard it is to shake your head and say you're actually quite comfortable while wiping beads of sweat off your upper lip and fanning yourself with a dirty paper plate? Here's a trick. As you go through the buffet line, accidentally grab two paper plates. Then you won't be spraying yourself with macaroni salad, which, while refreshing, is murder on a black sweater. And here's another tip for people like me who prefer the security of outerwear. If it happens to be cold out, but you continue to wear a jacket indoors because this is how you feel most comfortable and attractive, people will constantly ask whether you're cold. You will want to say yes as an explanation for why you're wearing the coat. I tend to run cold, you will be tempted to say, hoping the way you're holding a frosty root beer against your forehead while perched next to the fan and panting isn't giving you away. Take it from me. Don't do it. If you do, then your gracious host will turn up the heat and, in essence, cookie right out of your jacket. One of the scariest nights of my life involved the date I was on, where the guy kept cranking the heat because I was saying I was cold. When I finally couldn't take it anymore and went to take the jacket off, he balked. "No, leave it on," he murmured into my sweaty ear. Let's pretend we're at a ski resort. I'm not sure if he was trying to seduce me or kill me, but it was far too hot for any kind of role play. "How about I'll be a skier and you be a snowboarder and I'll do my best to avoid you," I suggested as I stuck my head in the freezer. So anyway, I probably won't be going to the party, but I will be turning up the AC and having my own winter wonderland party of one. Well, one and a half if you count my dog that's always wearing fur. Sweaters encouraged. I did not go to that party, and then when I saw photos posted of the party, of course I wished I had gone. But I don't have tiki attire. Tropical attire, I mean. Tropical attire fit for a tiki party. Please stop yelling in a little box. The illustration is a TV screen. At the bottom it says live CNN, NSA leaker, hero or traitor. And then there's 10 little talking head boxes on the screen. I really don't know how to feel about all this NSA stuff. It's complicated and nuanced, and I find myself going back and forth. Am I the only one? I can't imagine I am, and yet every time I turn on the TV, there's someone in a little box yelling in a way that suggests he or she knows exactly how I'm supposed to feel. And by little box, I'm not referring to the TV itself. TVs are no longer little boxes. They are giant rectangles mounted in all manner of places, increasingly including the outdoors. Because what's a barbecue without a giant orange legal analyst yelling at you about the government? No, by little boxes, I'm referring to all the talking heads beamed onto the screen at once who are yelling at one another and you, often all at the same time, like a monstrous Brady Bunch fever dream. There was a time when having a nuanced, measured, well-considered take on something, one that didn't fit neatly into, well, a box, was appreciated. Those days are gone. Today you have to turn your opinion into a slogan and make it as loud and attention-grabbing as possible. Mind you, this was years before Trump. Despite what cynics say, it's not that the news only wants to present one side. It's that it wants to present one side per person. Instead of having a single voice canvass the issue, which feels calm and mature, the preference is to have two or more people, best if they hate each other, go head-to-head with the goal of never agreeing, like a blood sport. And it's a real shame because this process takes once intelligent viewpoints and exaggerates them to the point where they're no longer recognizable, pumping them full of hot air and stripping them of subtlety. If opinions were people, these ones walked in looking like folks you went to high school with and walked out looking like the women on The Real Housewives of Orange County. Giant lips, big boobs, and kind of entertaining to watch, but what the hell was that? I don't understand why we've abandoned the idea of complexity. It's the one best suited for the world we live in. Complexity exists in pockets, newspaper articles that are TLDR, an online acronym for too long didn't read, dry NPR broadcasts, people who speak in a British accent. But you really have to seek these out. By contrast, opinions that are simplified and yelled are everywhere. The media has turned into a live, breathing, all caps, 24-hour Twitter feed. And I'm not just talking about what I witness as a spectator. I've been on the inside of the opinion factory, and I've seen how the opinions are made. It happens like this. A producer of a news show contacts you and says the host wants to do a segment about a certain issue and needs someone to argue a certain side. Is that you? And then, if you say yes, you will be expected to be frothing at the mouth to argue this one side. Should you allow nuance into your argument, you will feel you've let them down just a little. They wanted a cockfight. You gave them rhythmic gymnastics. I remember I was doing one of these shows, and we were talking about the stories before we did the show, and one of the producers was like, "We gotta find the heat," like, for each story. It's like, the challenge is, how do we find the heat? Because it was like a fairly staid story. It wasn't one with a lot of controversy, but that's like what he was telling all of us, including the host, find the heat. I think there's this idea that, I'm stepping on my own story. And the thing is, everyone involved will actually understand what happened because they know they've simplified something complex into opposing bits of pablum. They themselves probably fall somewhere in the middle, as any sentient being would. But you see, they didn't bring you on to be sentient, or to be a human being. They brought you on to sit in a box and yell. It's a shame, because it's not as if we, the public, demand this oversimplification. The popularity of shows like Mad Men, Game of Thrones, and The Sopranos proves we're very good at hanging out in the uncertain middle ground, exploring the space between the extremes, calibrating our sympathies and affection for people and worlds that are clearly both good and bad. In fact, we enjoy puzzling through contradictions. But back to the NSA stuff. I find I'm just not as appalled as I get the feeling I should be. Is it because the ramifications are so abstract? Or because I suspected this was going on anyway? Or because I have nothing to hide? And yet, it's not as if I'm totally fine with it either, because I don't think we really know yet the full scope of the surveillance and in what way it's been wielded. I have to assume there are more of me, people who are somewhere in the middle, than there are of them, people whose extreme certainty knows no bounds. We just aren't yelling about it. The Uninvited House Guest. The illustration for this one is a cockroach sitting, or standing, lounging really, on a bar of soap in a soap dish. I lived in New York for almost 10 years and was lucky enough to never see a cockroach in my apartment. I saw plenty of other unpleasant things. Mice, a junkie throwing up in my kitchen sink, an air conditioning unit in the process of falling from its perch in the window. I shrieked and pulled it in by the extension cord, and my hair after a hard rain, but never a cockroach. Now I live in Los Angeles, where I've traded in gritty realness for a better, cheaper apartment with wall-to-wall carpeting, modern amenities, and a parking space. All the downsides of urban living are supposed to be behind me, so I was somewhat alarmed to peer over at the bathroom counter. Oh, and I have counters, bite-me pedestal sinks, to find a cockroach the size of a small egg roll hanging out near my soap dish. Instead of the kind of insect I usually find, some kind of wispy winged creature that's long and thready and disintegrates into nearly nothing when you smush it, a roach has substance. It's crunchy and jarring. In a flash, I wondered how long he'd been there and whether he'd taken any detours through my makeup brushes and face soap, which were sitting out uncovered. And why was he so close to my retainer case? Granted, I haven't worn my retainers in years, but that could change any day, so long as it doesn't mean risking roach detritus. He seemed kind of still, so I grabbed an empty container of false eyelashes, which is a flimsy plastic box, and attempted to trap my uninvited guest. Unfortunately, he resisted rehoming and scurried into the sink. I shrieked. It was time to call in reinforcements. "Large bug! Large bug!" I yelled to my fiancé. He got a look, gasped, and threw his shoe in the sink. "Did I get it?" he yelled from across the room. "No," I responded, standing on the toilet. He removed his other shoe and made another hole in one, which didn't graze the bug either. I questioned this strategy. What if he had angered the roach? Then, acting on pure impulse, he fished a shoe from the sink and whacked the bug. The fact that he's still wearing these shoes is freaking me out. For the rest of the day, I couldn't shake the feeling that things were amiss, a feeling that was perhaps exacerbated by helpful friends promising that if you have one roach, you probably have thousands. This is an aside. I did a podcast during this whole roach situation, which, spoiler, turned out to just be one roach. But during that time, I interviewed Kevin Rahm of Mad Men and other shows, whom I love. And he is the one who was like, if you have one, you have a bunch of them. As when we had mice in our apartment, I find myself wondering why I'm so disturbed. What is the genesis of the fear? In truth, I'm a lot bigger than these things. And mice can be cute in a Disney film or even at a pet store, so why the panic? People will say it's because these critters carry diseases and we've evolved to fear them, but I don't think it's that. I think it's the fear of little things crawling around or on your body or up your leg and into your mouth. At one point in New York, when I was most desperate and irrational, but not yet ready to call an exterminator, clearly what I should have done from the beginning, I tried to give the mice names. Perhaps if I were to view them as friendly creatures that happened to share my living space, I thought, I would be less upset by their presence. It didn't work. Plus, they never came when called. I believe the names I gave them were Rob, Chad, and Grover. And yes, that is a reference to the Lowe brothers. I don't equate them with mice. I'm a fan. I just thought they were good names. Not willing to cede my domicile just yet, I turned to my dad for a solution. He's old. He doesn't like bugs. Maybe he would have some advice. Instead, he did that super annoying thing that old people do, got philosophical. Roaches and humans have been coexisting for millions and millions of years, he said. They were probably living in caves with early man. Great, I said. I don't want them in my bathroom. Then the Confucius of entomology offered a comforting pearl of wisdom. He said, they're all over. They're everywhere. I resisted the urge to throw my shoe at him. I told my landlord, and he brought an exterminator around. Have you ever noticed how exterminators are always sweaty? It's high-intensity work, this bug killing. Anyway, he asked me how big the roach was. I told him. He determined this to mean that it had come in from the outside. I shudder to think about whether that means bigger or smaller ones are living inside. He said he sprayed outside, so we really shouldn't have any more, but if we find another one, he'll come back and spray the lower cabinets. I feel good that we have a plan, but I think we should move in the meantime. Thankfully, that was... that's not true. I did not see another one until many years later. This year, in fact. Our washing machine broke and overflowed, and a whole bunch of water poured out into the laundry room and then into the kitchen, and then we cleaned it all up, and there was a dead roach in the laundry room. I don't know where that means it came from. But other than those two, I thankfully have not seen any more, and I hope I'm not bringing a plague of cockroaches upon myself by mentioning this. As in the earlier story, I'm not superstitious, except I am. Let's get a dog's opinion. The illustration is three cute but ugly dogs. I realize everyone who knows anything about dogs says the humane thing to do is spay or neuter them. My feeling has always been that it's really easy for us to say that, but let's get a dog's opinion. Somehow I suspect they would take a less hardline stance. Despite my misgivings, we just had our little guy neutered, because if you live in Los Angeles and don't neuter your pet, you'll be run out of town by a screaming mob of people with pitchforks who shop at Whole Foods and do CrossFit. It was awful. For me, that is. Oliver seemed fine. But back to me. The vet told us to drop Oliver off in the morning between 7:30 a.m. and 9 a.m. My fiancé and I arrived a little before 9 a.m. and waited about an hour before anyone took us in. This afforded us ample time to feel guilty, me, nap, Oliver, question what we were doing, me, read news stories on our iPhone, Daniel, look around nervously, me, watch a video about cat parasites, all of us, and whine, Oliver and me. I get that we live in a very crowded world, but I remember a time when the term waiting room wasn't so literal, and seeing a doctor didn't involve sitting in the aforementioned room for at least an hour. These days, going to the gynecologist for an annual checkup is an all-day affair. And don't even get me started on how you wait in the waiting room for an hour, and then the nurse finally takes you into the exam room and weighs you, takes your blood pressure, asks a bunch of nosy questions, and says, the doctor will be in shortly, only for you to wait for another eternity. At the very least, how about the medical community provide us with something more entertaining to pass the time than a plastic model of our reproductive organs, a video about ablation, I don't know what it is and I don't want to know, and a bunch of parenting magazines. How about personal satellite TVs and a quesadilla station? But back to the vet. While we were waiting, and I was repeatedly apologizing to Daniel because I expected this to be a quick thing, but now he was late for work, I kept looking around at all the pets that were nowhere near as cute as Oliver. I mean, it was truly one ugly dog after the other. By the time we were finally called, I was experiencing full-on paranoia, wondering whether the people who work there really love animals as much as they pretend they do. What if the minute we leave, they turn into Disney villains? What if this is the last time I'll see Oliver because something horrible will happen to him on the tiny operating table, all because I signed him up for a procedure I was second-guessing? It was more than I could bear. I drowned my sorrows in stale cookies from a jar with a sign reading, "These treats are for humans." If I had to stay there any longer, I would have sampled the complimentary dog and cat treats as well, because fear makes me hungry. I went home and waited and waited and waited and waited, and then I waited some more. I should really take advantage of this time to do all the things I can't do when Oliver is here, I thought to myself. I kicked off my shoes and socks and left them right in the middle of the floor. I opened all the doors, ate string cheese without being sneaky, and watered some hanging plants without having to hold the pots over my head so as to avoid the tendrils dragging on the floor. It was a real party, but I couldn't shake the feeling that this is what it would be like if Oliver were gone. When the nurse told me over the phone that everything went fine and I could come pick him up, I cried a little, because I am ridiculous. Recovery was fast, and I learned a couple of valuable lessons. Getting your dog neutered in Los Angeles costs more than getting your appendix removed in another town, and if I ever have children, I'm going to think twice before getting them fixed. I do the same thing when Elliot, my human baby, for anyone who's tuned in the middle of this audiobook, which I don't think people do, if Daniel takes Elliot out and I'm home without Elliot, I always think, well, now is the time for me to do whatever it is I can't do with him around. And then I begin to get depressed, though, thinking, well, this is what it would be like if he weren't here. But these days, pretty much what I do that I can't do when he's around is either nap or shower. So it's not like all of a sudden I play with sharp objects or something. I'm afraid of fun. The illustration for this one is a cat. It's a grumpy cat wearing a July 4th Uncle Sam hat. Now that July 4th is safely behind us, I must confess something that may change how you feel about me. I hate firecrackers. I don't just dislike them. I hate them. Hate them. Hate them. I hate when teenagers light them in the street. I hate when friends fire them off balconies. And I particularly hate when someone decides to modify them. This kicks the whole experience up a notch from terrifying to panic-inducing soil my pants. And I don't think soil was my first choice of word there. And why is it that everyone must collect in the street to watch the lighting of the modified firecrackers? Can't I enjoy the delicious exhilaration of wondering whether I'm going to lose any fingers or eyes from inside the house behind a comforting bowl of guacamole? Is it absolutely necessary that I join the masses? I'm just going to ruin everyone's fun with my, is it supposed to do that? And are you sure this is legal? And, oh, these? I always wear safety goggles. Dogs really have an edge when it comes to disliking explosives. Everyone accepts that dogs freak out around both fireworks and firecrackers, so people keep them far away or put them in dog anxiety jackets, which are real things that I wish came in people sizes. The only thing us anxious humans can do is drink alcohol, which seems like a bad idea when the goal is to avoid being extra flammable. And for the record, I also dislike barbecues, the beach, football, and hot tubs. I'm as un-American as apple clafoutie. Here's my question. Are there people who actually go nuts for barbecues? There must be. There must be people who love barbecues as much as I love my favorite activity, looking at pictures of ducklings on the internet. I wish I were the kind of person who leapt from the sheets on July 4th, excited to slap on a bunch of sunscreen and stand in the hot sun swatting at flies and flipping meat. Just the feel of grass poking through my sandal is enough to make me long for winter. Hell, just wearing sandals does it. The human foot wasn't meant to be partially caged in strappy leather. It was meant to be fully caged in some kind of Oxford or boot. But the thing is, I want people to think I'm fun. I want them to think I'm fun, spontaneous, and always up for a good time. I want them to think I'm like one of those fun girls with beachy waves and a wraparound skirt sitting in the back of a Jeep in a beer commercial. Perhaps I play sand volleyball. Maybe I bring my golden retriever to the beach. I could possibly wave flirtatiously while snow skiing. In my fantasies, I'm the kind of person who might yell woo atop some weenie's shoulders, start the wave, employ a skyrider, or join a drum circle. Will I ride a skidoo backwards? Will I board a small, unsafe-looking boat in choppy water? Will I make out with you on a Ferris wheel? Yes, yes, and yes. I mean, in reality, no, never. But in this fantasy world, count me in. Basically, I want people to think that having some kind of barbecue, clam bake, bonfire, or limbo contest without me wouldn't be the same, which is technically true. It would be better. But but I don't want them to know that. See, my fear of being seen as the kind of person who's afraid of firecrackers is outpaced only by my fear of firecrackers. What should I do? What would our forefathers have done? Let's keep this between us until I figure it out. Still feel roughly the same. Great new denim. The illustration for this one is a pair of jeans. Kind of high-waisted. The older I get, the more I think life isn't about avoiding pain, but surviving it. You can try to outrun life's profoundly upsetting experiences, but sadly it won't work. Invariably, you'll find yourself at the funeral of a loved one, in the hospital receiving a troubling diagnosis, or at a department store trying to buy jeans. I'd put it off for as long as I could, hoping no one would notice I was wearing the same pair every day. As long as I switch up the shirt, I thought, who's really going to notice? Plus, I do most of my work from home. I'm only around other human beings for a scant few hours each day. For all they know, I spend the bulk of my time donning a rich pageant of colorful and varied garb, each hour on the hour choosing a new garment from my plentiful collection of overalls, skorts, culottes, pedal pushers, skirts, both maxi and mini, sarongs, wrap dresses, rompers, jumpers, and jorts. For all they know, I wear something once and throw it out. For all they know, I still keep the notebook I started in high school, in which I'd write down what I wore each day, accessories included, to make sure I didn't repeat outfits. So this particular notebook was yellow, and had regular notebook paper inside, but the cover was kind of ribbed, like, in rubbery material. I'm making it sound like a condom. It wasn't that. But do you remember in the later years of Facts of Life when it switched from Eastland to Edna's Edibles to the novelty store over our heads? This notebook was like something you would find I bought it at a store that was similar to that store. It specialized in stationery, but I think it was called Ixies. I don't know if it was a chain or if there was just that one. Okay, then. Back when I started that notebook, I had a lot of clothes and not that many friends. These days, I have a lot of friends, who I don't see that often, and not that many clothes. Actually, I have a lot of clothes. I just don't wear that many of them. Which brings me back to the one pair of jeans I wear, the other pair that I used to wear, and the rest of the pairs in my closet, which are really just placeholders at this point, a remembrance of Jean's past. Seeing as I hate shopping, I'm always overwhelmed when I head to the department store to rustle up some pants. But I did it one day. I traveled right into the overly loud top 40 blaring heart of the beast and rifled through pair after pair of very expensive designer skinny jeans, which is not my preferred cut, in an array of dark and light rinses and waists varying from low-rise to obscenely low. The jeans and I went to a dressing room. I pulled on a pair. They didn't come up high enough and were too long. I waddled around the room, squinting at myself, trying to see whether there was any way that with some altering they'd be worth over $200. That is a thing I do in dressing rooms when I'm trying to get like a sense of the whole sort of gestalt of the clothing. I squint. It's weird. But it's what I do. Like somehow by blurring my vision, I can see more clearly. A very skinny, very fashionable 22-year-old sales girl knocked on my door to see whether I was finding everything okay, whether I needed any help, and whether I was excited about all the great new denim. So excited. I tried on a few more pairs, which pinched in the wrong places and flared in the wrong places and gave my muffin top a muffin top. And then, defeated and sweaty and feeling as if I'd thrown out my back, I decided life was too short and I would just come back another time when I was in a better mood. On my way out, as I made my way across the floor, I spied a wall of jeans near the bathroom. I wanted to turn and run away, but something called me over there. I was surprised because some were bootcut and weren't super extra low-rise. I looked around, confused. What department was this? It was quieter and calmer than the one I'd been in before. I swiveled my head around, trying to figure out if this weird section of clothing, tucked off the main floor like an afterthought, was for plus sizes or maternity or petite or something, anything, to explain the feeling that I was in a parallel universe. Or Canada. I saw no such signs. And then, a woman who was the opposite of the woman who helped me before was suddenly at my side,